Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hey, it's Cindy Howes and Lizzie Noh from the podcast Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians.
Basic Folk is truly changing the game with our well-researched deep dives that aim to empower the listener while fostering the folk community.
I basically am writing worship music for youth group rejects.
Maternal regrets and maternal guilt are universal.
I try to make things that are beautiful and that are made with like a purity of intention.
You can listen to Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or at basicfolk.com.
Hey everybody, Tom Power here from Canada, where I am unable to get across the border because of the pandemic. So we're waiting a little bit longer for the second season of Toy Harp. I like to be able to do these things in person. I think I might do a couple over Zoom. If you have any opinions on this, please let me know. But yeah, it's going to be a little bit longer for our second season of Toy Harp. So in the meantime, I wanted to let you know about another podcast from BGS that I think you might dig. It's called The Breakdown. On every episode, fellow Canadian fiddler Patrick McGonigal and music journalist Emma John. Also, I think both a lot of non-Americans doing bluegrass podcasts here uncover bluegrass music one iconic record at a time. They talk about records that I love, like Flatten Scruggs at Carnegie Hall. I heard a story about that at one at that show, a guy had a pen with a light on it and they thought it was a joint or something like that. Bela Fleck's Drive, which we talked about in my Bela interview. The Grass is Blue from Dolly Parton. And to talk a little bit about the bizarre and compelling and back to bizarre stories behind some of these great bluegrass records. Today, I want to share one of the most downloaded episodes of The Breakdown. It's a deep dive behind Keith Whitley and Ricky Skaggs' debut album, Second Generation. I just got a copy of their Sing the Songs of the Stanley Brothers records, and it's wild to hear, you know. I mean, of course, Keith Whitley became this country superstar, died so tragically of alcohol poisoning, but they were these kids, and I remember Ricky tells me the story about how they, you know, when they met one another, they thought there was no one else like them on earth. Ricky thought he was the only kid who would like was that young and liked bluegrass, and so did Keith. So Patrick and Emma are going to tell you how these two teenagers managed to perfectly replicate the sound of the Stanley Brothers and talk about some of his final moments with Keith. So without further ado, hope to be able to get some a second season of Toy Harp to you soon. But The Breakdown is an amazing podcast. Check it out and subscribe over at thebluegrasssituation.com's podcast page.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, the podcast that uncovers the greatest sounds and stories in bluegrass music, one iconic record at a time.
I'm Emma John, author, journalist, and all-round bluegrass novice.
And I'm Patrick McGonigal, fiddle player with the Lonely Heartstring Band.
Today we're talking about Second Generation Bluegrass, which was recorded by the future country superstars Ricky Skaggs and Keith Whitley when they were still only teenagers. At 15 years old, these two prodigies had been taken on by Ralph Stanley, who invited them to join his band, the Clinch Mountain Boys, and you can hear their frankly eerie ability to emulate the style of Ralph and his late brother Carter, who were known to all as the Stanley Brothers, throughout this album.
And Ralph Stanley has always sounded like he's 90 years old, so they sound like people that are twice their age or three times their age, but the people that they're emulating sound like they're 90. It's amazing.
Wow. So if you really kind of factor in the maths, are we basically saying that in this record, which was recorded in June 1971, Ricky Skaggs sounds like he's 140 years old
or older? He's like a tortoise, or a sea turtle.
So let's explain the connection with the Stanley Brothers to start off with. The Stanley Brothers are one of the bluegrass legends of all time. They were pretty much second only to Bill Monroe in terms of their importance to early bluegrass.
And they really also were hugely important in the development of the bluegrass vocal style, the high lonesome tenor and the really incredible blend of vocals that bluegrass is now so famous for. So for two 15-year-olds who at that point were primarily singers to be so respected and taken under the wing of Ralph Stanley says a lot, I think, about where Keith Whitley and Ricky Skaggs were at such a young age.
They ended up in Ralph Stanley's band in 1970. They had an extraordinary story. It's almost a kind of stars in your eyes story of how they ended up in the Clinch Mountain Boys band, which was that the pair of them were asked to essentially stand in for Ralph Stanley when he was late for a gig. And it was a gig near their hometown, and they happened to have their instruments in the car. And the manager of the place was desperately looking around for something that he could entertain the crowd with until Ralph Stanley arrived. So the pair of them stood up and played Ralph Stanley's songs.
And Ralph Stanley then wanders into the bar and hears them singing before he sees them and assumes for a moment that it's actually the Stanley brothers playing over the bar's stereo. And then apparently Ralph Stanley went and then sat in the front row and hurled requests at young Keith and Ricky while they continued to play with Ralph Stanley sitting there.
They were pretty much hired. I don't know whether it was that week, that month. They were basically on tour with Ralph Stanley pretty soon after that.
Yeah, they hit the road young and they really traveled all around the world with Ralph.
All around the world or all around America?
Well, Keith Whitley traveled all around the world with Ralph. I don't know if they traveled all around the world at 15, but I know that Keith, as a teenager, was traveling to Japan with the Clinch Mountain Boys. And it was definitely an important moment for both of them.
It was actually the second record that Keith and Ricky had recorded within 6 months, the first being the very prosaically titled A Tribute to the Stanley Brothers, which was exactly what it says on the tin. It was an album that was all Stanley Brothers songs because that was what they loved and that was what they did well. This one still has a lot of Stanley Brothers songs on it.
It has Ralph Stanley himself on it. It has Jack Cook playing the bass. Jack Cook, of course, played with Ralph Stanley for years and was himself a band leader for bluegrass styles. He actually sounds a lot like Ralph when he sings. And then, of course, Curly Ray Klein plays fiddle all over the record. If it's not Ricky playing, it's Curly Ray playing, and Curly Ray played with the Stanley Brothers and later with Ralph and the Clinch Mountain Boys. So it's not a direct tribute to the Stanley Brothers, but it's the next best thing. In their style.
There are still 7 songs that Stanley Brothers recorded back in the day that are on this. But then there are some other really interesting tunes that we'll get into. I wanted to just say that I first listened to this on a drive with you, actually.
Yep. Yep.
Returning from a festival. And I remember as you put this on and started raving about this record and how much you wanted us to talk about it, feeling really underwhelmed, I'm going to admit. I don't know if you could tell that at the time, but I wasn't. It felt like quite a brief record. It felt like it was over quite soon. Now that I've listened to it a lot more times, but also now that I've researched it and found out about all the different tracks and tunes and things that are going on behind the stories, I am completely fascinated by this record.
To me, it's definitely in my top 3, if not my favorite kind of bluegrass record. And what I mean by that is just it's a traditional record, but it's in my top 3 for sure. Mostly for The singing on this record is, to me, absolutely standout.
Well, let's start with the singing. The very first track is Don't Cheat in Our Hometown, which, a classic song recorded by Stanley Brothers. And what is, I think, amazing about listening to this is the emotion that is in this song. I would say if Flatt and Scruggs were the ultimate entertainers of bluegrass, then the Stanley Brothers were the ultimate emoters in bluegrass.
Definitely, yeah.
This is what Ricky Skaggs and Keith Whitley have completely captured to the point of, you know, it's beyond imitation. It's perfect. Replication of that feeling and that character, which, again, I come back to it, they were 15 years old. How on earth did they know how to sound like somebody who's being cheated on by his girlfriend / wife? I it's amazing, right, to me that they can get that across, be so expressive.
Tonight my heart is beating and my head is bowed. You've been seen with my best friend on the other side of town. I don't mind this waiting, don't mind this running around. But if you're gonna cheat on me,
this feeling like that they're losers. Isn't that a terrible thing to say? But that's how I feel about this song, is that, you know, this great kind of like sadness, but like pitiable sadness in this singer.
I agree.
You spend all your pastime making me a clown.
The sentiment of that song of just like, I guess I'll take it. It's kind of Eeyore-ish. It's like, oh, well, you know, if you can cheat on me, just don't cheat in our hometown. I would argue that neither of them had, experienced the sentiment of the song. At least I hope not at 15. But, you know, I think the reason that they're able to so effectively transmit the depth of this music is because they both grew up in such musical homes. Both of Keith's parents played music, his parents Elmore and Faye Whitley, and his mother played piano and organ and banjo and guitar and taught he and his siblings how to play guitar and sing traditional songs. Keith Whitley's grandfather was a banjo player and taught both he and his brother how to play banjo, and that sparked their interest in bluegrass. And Keith was extremely interested in country singers from a very young age. His older siblings and his mother talk about how as an infant, you know, almost as young as he could just start talking, he would sing, and he was singing along with his siblings, and he loved Lefty Frizzell and George Jones. And apparently by the age of 4 or 5, the only thing he wanted to do and the only thing he wanted to think about was singing country music. So already at 15, he's got all these elements, this pure voice, this incredible control, this tone. It's all there. The timing, he really had it worked out.
So we've talked about Keith's musical upbringing. We should definitely talk about Ricky's musical upbringing, because Ricky's family is actually kind of featured on this record. One of the songs is written by his mum, Dorothy Skaggs, wrote All I Ever Loved Was You. And there's also a fiddle tune on this record called Son of Hobart, because Ricky's dad was called Hobart. Ricky's dad is a really interesting character. I mean, both his mum and his dad are really interesting characters. Did you know that Ricky essentially ended up playing mandolin and singing because Ricky's dad, Hobart, used to love singing and playing music with his brother? And his brother was killed in World War II. And after he lost his brother, who, by the way, apparently was awarded a Purple Heart for his bravery in which he was killed on the island of Guam. His dad was really brokenhearted and really wanted somebody to sing and play music with, and that turned out to be Ricky. His mum sang as well, and she wrote songs. She apparently, Ricky says, because his dad was a welder and was away from home on jobs a lot, so she wrote a lot of love songs because she missed Hobart so much. And All I Ever Loved Was You is one of those.
All I ever loved was you. You broke a heart to cry for you. I've wasted all my tears on you. For all I ever loved was you.
I think the moment that it became one of my favorite records of all time was when I was driving just north of San Francisco in a rental van by myself, and I put this record on and I was listening to it and I was really into it, and this track in particular came on, and it's a beautiful violin or fiddle kickoff. Curly Ray Klein plays a little turnaround, and then they immediately launch into the chorus, which is a beautiful chorus, and their vocals are, as always, stunning and perfectly locked in. But Curly Ray on the fiddle weaves through the opening harmonies unbelievably beautifully and really acts as this third voice that's kind of improvising and dancing around the original melody. And I remember listening to that, and it caught my attention. And I restarted the track several times on this drive because I just had to hear that over and over again. It's some of the most soulful fiddle playing I can think of in of all of the recordings.
What do you think of the fiddle playing at the beginning of Paul Monroe? And is that Curly Ray Klein or is it Ricky Skaggs? I have no idea. I wouldn't know how to tell the difference.
I don't know who it is, but with Paul Monroe, there's mandolin, beautiful mandolin all over it. And I would imagine that it must be Curly Ray just by virtue of this track having incredible mandolin on it.
I wrote a note about, just like you were saying about the intro to All I Ever Loved Was You, I wrote a note about the intro to Paul Monroe, and I just wrote crunchy.
Crunchy.
That's the only way I could think of to describe it. It's got these funny fifths that sound crunchy to my ear.
Just because he's lazy, sets around with the blues, they run Monroe off without his shoes. He always was lazy and he never liked to work, but nice feet the bird as he runs through the dirt.
I actually don't really understand what Paul Monroe is about. Apart from it being about a lazy man, I'm not really sure what the what the conclusion or what the moral of the story we're supposed to take away is.
And also there's this weird line about how, because now he's been run off without his shoes, his family's eligible for welfare?
It's really bizarre. It makes me think. So it was written by Roy Lee Centers, who was obviously lead singer for Ralph Stanley at the time, lead vocalist for Ralph Stanley at the time, and who is playing guitar, acoustic guitar on this record. And it's such an odd song that it makes me think that he had someone in mind when he was writing about it. There was some very specific situation in his life that he was writing about. It's like one big inside joke.
I agree. But the other element of it that I think is kind of inside joke-ish, like you say, is that it's not about Bill Monroe, but Ricky Skaggs is sure playing a whole lot of Monroe licks. And you hear the line, just like Monroe, and then you hear like a perfect Monroe mandolin lick. And there's a beautiful mandolin break on it. And the mandolin break is all Monroe stuff.
he's mandolin playing. Can we mention Daybreak and Dixie? I would love your musician's view on this particular rendition of this tune, because it sounds to me like the mandolin is trying to push the beat all the time in a way that's kind of like quite showy. Is that true?
When I think of Ricky Skaggs' mandolin playing, one of the things that I think of is how he is so incredibly able to sit right on the front of the beat all the time. And his chop. So in my band, the Lonely Heartstring Band, our mandolin player, Maddie, loves to play the mandolin chop right on the front of the beat. And always, if we're kind of saying, we think you're pushing it a little much or you're rushing or something, Ricky Skaggs recordings start popping out of the phones during rehearsal to as a display of, yeah, well, check out Ricky's drive and look how far ahead he puts it on the beat. And listening to Daybreak and Dixie this morning, my notes right here have Ricky is playing on the front of the beat. So at 15 years old, he has decided he's made that call already in his career and his musical style to put that sound. And I think it drives the tune incredibly.
Wondered whether this is the track where he felt he got to really show off his skills, and that was probably like quite important to him, because he was playing in a band where you didn't particularly show off instrumentally. Yeah. He was playing mm-hmm. for this, you know, mountain music legend Ralph Stanley, who wanted to make sure that everything was subject to the singing and or subservient to the singing rather.
Yeah.
And Ricky has definitely written in his autobiography, Kentucky Traveler, about how he was a young kid. He was like learning these showy, fast-paced licks, and Ralph would sometimes have to turn him down or rein him in, I guess.
Yeah. So the other place where Ricky really gets to strut his stuff is Son of Hobart, but on that track he's playing fiddle, and he plays beautifully and. You know, but I think this is a very different mandolin vibe.
The fiddle tune, Son of Hobart, is incredibly, it's a very different groove. It's a much more old-timey vibe. And, I mean, the entire tune is only played over one single yeah. chord, yeah. which is yeah. unusual even in old time, I would say. It's interesting because Ricky writes, again, he does write about how he was incredibly influenced by a 70-year-old old-time fiddler called... Hmm. Let me just check this guy's name. I think he was called Sanford, but I guess, you know, if I was doing it with the real Southern accent, it would be Sanford. Kelly. And this guy was really, really important to him. He was a kind of... A very old school, old time fiddler to the extent that, like, you didn't know when he was going to turn up in town. He sort of came and went, and he didn't have a phone, so people couldn't particularly get in touch with him. And he would just occasionally kind of rock up in a car and play music with and for Ricky. And there's a great quote, which I think explains a lot, and it ties a lot of this stuff together that Ricky writes in his book. He says, "The lonely sound I heard in Sanford's music helped me understand why I was drawn to the music of the Stanley brothers. They too had that high lonesome old stank from the Virginia Hills."
Oh, love it. The high lonesome stank. Gotta have a lot of stank. Well, it's like, and some people talk about when you scrunch up your face, when you're really getting into the music, if you're playing and you scrunch up your face, they call that the stank face. So, stank
is
everywhere.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
While we're on Son of Hobart, can we go back to Ricky's dad? Because I feel like there's one other
thing. Let's go back.
Let's talk about Ricky's dad some more, because quite apart from his relationship with Uncle Ockel, who was the brother who died in the war, Ricky's dad Hobart had an incredibly important, accelerating effect on Ricky's career. I mean, he was the one who practiced long, long hours into the night with. Ricky grew up in eastern Kentucky in a town called Brushy Creek in Lawrence County. But they moved around a little bit for his dad's work. And his dad actually took a job in Goodlettsville, Tennessee, so that they could be near Nashville and near the Opry and see if there were opportunities.
Also, I think Hobart and probably both of his parents were taking Ricky to shows all the time. And Ricky really loved going to bluegrass shows. And I think that was a big part of, you know, it was like, it's almost like a sports parent today, just like driving the long hours to expose the kids to this great music. And as a result, as you said, he got to play with the Stanley Brothers. He, you know, a formative moment that he mentions all the time from stage and in interviews is sitting in with Bill Monroe as a very young guy. And I think his dad always said, take your instrument and we'll go to lots of shows. And, I would say that the strategy worked.
You say like a sports parent. That's exactly what I thought of, because I read that he didn't even let Ricky play any sports. Ricky wasn't allowed to play sports, especially baseball, all the things that the other kids were playing, because he was too worried about him hurting his hands, you know, potentially breaking a finger. It made me think of, I've just read a biography of Tiger Woods, and Earl Woods, you know, was exactly the same with Tiger when he was young. Yeah. He was absolutely not allowed to play with the kids in the schoolyard. He wasn't allowed to do any of the things the other kids were doing because it was just too dangerous. You know, they were so set on him having this golfing career. So Ricky ended up moving back to eastern Kentucky. The family ended up moving back there. It's kind of amazing, given how much Ricky was involved in music and how much his dad had him playing all over the place, that he actually had never met Keith Whitley before. Mm-hmm. This kid who was exactly the same age as him, to the point that they were born in the same month.
Yeah.
And who was equally in love with the Stanley Brothers and living 30 miles down the road, they'd never heard of each other.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't connect on Facebook. I would have assumed that Facebook would have, you know, put them together and suggested that they be friends. But I guess Facebook dropped the ball back in the 60s.
In the end, Ricky and Keith met at a talent show when they were about 14 years old. And we got to sit down with Ricky at the IBMA conference in Raleigh. So the first thing we asked him was for his memories of that first meeting.
We ended up in the boys' locker room downstairs, you know, where our instrument cases were, you know, it's like a little green room of some sort, you know. So we ended up down there, and there was nobody there but just me and him. And we started talking, you know, about, oh, who do you listen to, you know, and, well, I listen to the Stanley Brothers. Well, who do you like? I said, well, I love the Stanley Brothers too. Mm-hmm. Do you know this one? And here we started singing, and we stood there and sang for, I don't know how long, maybe 30 or 40 minutes, maybe an hour. And so the next weekend, I invited Keith to come and to come over and visit at our house for dinner and bring his guitar, and his brother Dwight came, brought the banjo. And so me and my dad and him and Dwight, you know, played, and we just had the best time, and we became soul brothers, you know, right then at 15 years old, and just bonded a relationship, you know, and so much of it was built around the Stanley Brothers.
Do you remember when you first heard the Stanley Brothers and what it was you first listened to?
I was hearing Stanley Brothers songs, I think, before I actually heard the Stanley Brothers. I used to listen to my mother and dad sing Rank Stranger in church. And so I just kind of thought Mom wrote it, you know, because Mom wrote songs. And, you know, so I heard the radio one day, and I heard the Stanley Brothers sing. And I said, Mom, they're doing your song. She said, No, honey, we do their song. That they were the ones that come out with it.
I wandered again to my home in the mountain, where a new early dawn, I was happy and free. I looked for my friend, but I never.
My grandfather, my mother's dad, was having some health issues. And he lived up in Ohio. He'd moved up there from Kentucky and was a night watchman on a really expensive horse farm that raised thoroughbreds. You know, one of them won a Kentucky Derby one year. But while we were in Columbus, we would go downtown to a place called the Astro Inn. And it was just a beer joint, a hillbilly beer joint, you know. It held about maybe 50, 75 people, you know. We went to see Earl Taylor one night. And so before we got there, we got downtown a little early, and there was a record shop down in Columbus. And so we went in, me and my dad went in there. And I had no idea about these reissue records that had come out in the 70s of things that they'd cut in the 40s and the 50s. They had Mercury stuff, and they had the Columbia stuff, and they had the richer tone stuff. Anyway, I got to going through those records, and I said, Dad, can we get this one? You know, yeah, we can get that. It was not four or five bucks, you know. And then we'd look at another one. There would be the Columbia collection of Stanley Brothers. I said, can we get this one too, you know? And so we ended up, I saw my dad, bless his heart, my dad pulled out a folded $100 bill that he had hidden in his wallet, that just for like emergencies, you know. And so he pulled that $100 bill out and broke it, you know, just to pay for those records. But those records, yeah, you know, they did something to me. Ralph, I loved Mr. Monroe's music, you know, I always loved his music, and his Man on Plan especially. But there was something so ancient sounding in the Stanley Brothers. The spirit of the music was just, I mean, it would grab you, those songs, and the way they sang, Ralph sang tenor to Carter's lead, you know.
Everybody I met
seemed to be a rank stranger.
And then Carter passes.
No mother.
And so one night we'd heard that Ralph had hired a new lead singer. They said, "Oh, he sounds just like Carter," you know. And it was Roy Lee Centers, you know, and that he did. I'm telling you. So anyway, we begged Dad, please take us over to this beer joint over in Fort Gay, West Virginia, which is right across from Louisa, Kentucky, where I was going to high school, And here we got, you know, we couldn't have got in there without my dad, you know. You know, we were 15. And so we go to see Ralph play with this new singer. And, well, we were sitting there kind of waiting for Ralph to get there. And place was filling up, you know. The guy said Ralph called and they've had bus trouble and they're going to be half hour, 40 minutes before they can get here. Said, would you boys like get up and do some songs? And so we said, yeah. And so we get up. Well, the only songs we know is Stanley Brothers songs. But because of those records that I had bought in Columbus a year or so before that, me and Keith had learned so many of those old songs, because Ralph and Carter was kids then. They were just in their early 20s when they recorded those first things. And so seeing their pictures on the front cover, it's like they weren't that much older than what we were. So Ralph comes walking in. Here comes Ralph, you know, my hero. I remember what he had on. He had on a pair of black pants and boots, and he had a leather jacket. I mean, I was looking at the audience, but he was right there, and I couldn't turn far enough. You know, I'd have to do that and to not see Ralph. You know, it was like, oh my God, he's listening to everything we're doing, and I'm singing his parts. I'm singing the tenor part. Oh my God, don't let me mess up. And he said, I just got to tell you, it really blesses my heart to see young kids really liking what we do, you know, what we, me and Carter did, and keeping that alive, you know. Well, our hearts about burst inside us. We were so happy.
It's lucky that he didn't walk in and say, you've just ruined our set list.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for playing every song that we do, you know. But anyway, that just led to a really, really great relationship with Ralph. Then as soon as we got out of high school, we joined his band full-time and worked for 2 years in the band. And then we did the Second Generation Bluegrass record, and that was for Rebel. And that was a pretty big deal to have a color picture on the front cover. Yeah, you know, yeah. Wow.
Have you looked at the artwork for this? For this record?
Well, yes. I've looked at a few. There's the one with them in the pink shirts.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
It's just a reminder of sort of how adorably young they are. Like that they just they still very, very, very much look like kids. Keith Whitley looks like an absolute choir boy, and
he doesn't know what to do with his hands. His hands look like they're fidgeting
hands.
With his pants.
And Ricky Skaggs has the biggest fringe that you have ever seen.
Another track that I love is Those Two Blue Eyes. To me, I feel like Those Two Blue Eyes is a moment when they really do their best Carter and Ralph impersonation.
You told me that your love was true, just like a fool I trusted. Those two blue eyes I love so well, what they done to me, no one can tell.
Do you happen to know who wrote it?
I don't know who wrote it.
I can tell you who wrote it.
This is
one of the many rabbit holes I ended up going down. Those Two Blue Eyes and Sea of Regret were both written by the Sloas brothers. I hope I'm saying that right. It's S-L-O-A-S. And they were a band from Isonville, Eastern Kentucky. I'm probably getting all of these pronunciations wrong because I'm just saying them in a British voice. But the Sloas brothers are this fascinating family. There were six brothers who all played instruments and a sister who wrote songs. Their parents were lost to them within, I think, a month of each other. They both caught measles and died of measles. And
wow.
Music was already important to the family. And I think after they lost their parents, it was an even bigger bond. However, you know, they all had families and they all needed to make a living. So while they did write songs and sell songs, they did not, you know, make it as a band themselves. They just used to kind of play locally, but they were kind of local legends, the Sloas brothers. And these are two of their songs. And their progeny ended up being significant musicians as well. There was a son called David Sloas, who ended up being Tammy Wynette's lead guitarist.
Wow.
From the early 80s until her death, apparently. And there was another son, Jimmy, who played with Megadeth.
Wow, I wonder if they ever collaborated.
My deceitful heart keeps changing its mind, hurting everyone but me.
Interesting songwriter on this record. I wonder if you know who wrote My Deceitful Heart.
I don't. I love that. It's one of my favorites on the record. One of my favorites.
That's interesting because I feel like it's in a very slightly different style to everything else. It kind of reminds me of a more... When I heard it for the first time, it made me think of my grandma. It made me think of the crooner records that she used to listen to. And it just feels very slightly different to everything else to me. And when I found out who wrote it, I thought, well, maybe this is why. It was written by a soul singer called Frederick Earl Long, whose nickname was Shorty. He was called Shorty Long. And he...
Short Long. I love that name.
Yeah.
Shorty Long.
Shorty Long. He was from Birmingham, Alabama, African-American, moved to Motown when he was 23. And he had been there writing, performing and producing in Detroit for 6 years when he died in a boat crash on the Detroit River. And wow. Stevie Wonder apparently played harmonica at his funeral. And that very harmonica is now buried with Shorty. Shorty also wrote another Stanley Brothers song. He wrote String, Eraser and Blotter.
Oh, I don't know that song. Sounds like a stationary song.
It does sound like a stationary song.
My fickle heart longs to be free.
There's one track we haven't mentioned, which is Dream of a Miner's Child, which is this sort of sad little story. Sad? I mean, it might be happy. We don't know what the ending
weird.
Is. It's
this Daddy, little... don't go to the mines today, for dreams have so often come true. It's a good one.
It's a good one. It's a kind of like potentially quite creepy story of a child who seems to have ESP and...
That's a technical way to put it.
That's a technical way to put it. And she thinks something catastrophic is about to
happen. The child, by the way, is played by Haley Joel Osment, and the father is played by Bruce Willis.
No, I think we established it's a female child.
Oh, right.
So it's probably played by Dakota Fanning or something like that.
Yeah, right.
And anyway, she's had a vision or a dream that something catastrophic is going to happen at the mine. So she doesn't want her dad to go to work today. We actually never find out in this song whether he goes or not. Very M. Night Shyamalan. Who knows if there's a twist in the tale. But the reason it's interesting that this song is on there is because when Ricky was working for Ralph, there was a day when his mum woke up and said... He was supposed to be going to Oklahoma on a gig with Ralph, and his mum woke up having had a dream that they had all been in the bus and they'd had a terrible crash. And his mum, Dorothy, songwriter Dorothy, said, "Ricky, I don't want you going to Oklahoma because I've basically had a premonition and you died in a crash." And Ricky phoned Ralph Stanley and said, "Ralph, can't come to the gig today. My mum's had a dream and she doesn't want me to go because she thinks I'm going to die in a car crash." And Ralph Stanley said, "Sure, no problem."
Wow.
Ralph Stanley.
Ricky, don't go to the gig today, for dreams have so often come true.
So Ricky did not go to Oklahoma. And when they came back from that gig, Ricky asked Roy Lee Centers if anything unusual had happened. And he was told, "Well, actually, when we were driving, a box fell off a truck in front of us and we had to swerve all over the road to avoid it."
Oh, Daddy, don't go to mines today, for dreams have so often come true. Oh, Daddy, dear Daddy, please don't go away. I never could live without you."
I do find it interesting that on this record, there's not a single track where Ricky sings lead. At this point, Ricky is exclusively just the tenor singer for Keith. which is just, you know, it's just maybe it's not even noteworthy at this point, but you know, Ricky is such an incredible singer, and he went on to have a career as a phenomenal lead singer.
And they didn't end up in a band together, even though they talked about it a lot, you know, during those 2 years that they were with Ralph. But obviously they'd been playing together even before then, and continued playing together after. But actually what happened was that Keith went off quite suddenly to be in a band with Carl Jackson and Jimmy Goodrow. And I think Ricky was quite taken by surprise and actually a little bit hurt.
That makes sense.
And that was it. They never really played together professionally again in that sense.
Yeah, and Keith went back and played for several years with Ralph, without Ricky in the band, and then went on, and they were both making country music in Nashville all through the 80s, and both doing very well at it. And
Ricky was always a little bit further ahead, it feels like, than Keith. Because Ricky actually went off, he went and joined the Country Gentlemen, and then he joined J.D. Crowe in New South. And and then Keith ended up with J.D. Crowe, a few years later. Ricky had left.
Yeah.
So it feels like Ricky was always, you know, maybe a step or two ahead in terms of career development.
Yeah. A step or two ahead in terms of career development, but also Keith Whitley, even though he only lived to be 34, had a career that was massively impactful. And just like Ricky is one of the biggest influences in bluegrass music and country music as well, I think it's safe to say that Keith Whitley, in terms of influence in country music, is as important as George Jones or Ray Price or any of the great singers in country music.
There's a Keith Whitley Carter Stanley parallel, which is the sad story of alcoholism and the toll it took on both of them. Carter had obviously died a few years before Keith joined Ralph and the Clinch Mountain Boys, but the same disease ended up taking his life, really.
Yeah, and I think for probably a lot of the same reasons, almost eerily similar in terms of touring with Ralph Stanley and the Clinch Mountain Boys as a teenager, traveling around the world, and being handed, I'm sure, a lot of drinks, and also, you know, as a teenager dealing with the pressure of performing every night like that with such a high level band and being so young, and the dangers of all of that definitely caught up with Keith. And despite his best efforts throughout the remainder of his life to try to quit drinking, he suffered greatly from the alcohol addiction and ended up dying of alcohol poisoning at 34 years old.
The love that you promised to me on that day is now gone forever, like the vows that you made. My heart is so empty.
My final question is, was it ever hard to listen to the records that you made with Keith after you lost him so early?
After he passed. It's kind of hard, you know. Sometimes I'll hear I'm No Stranger to the Rain come on a radio, and I turn it to another station sometimes. And it's no disrespect to him, but it's just like, it's just hard to listen to.
I'm no stranger to the rain. I'm a friend of thunder. Friend, is it any wonder lightning strikes me? I've fought with the devil, got down on his level, but I never gave in, so he gave up on me.
You know, It was a tragic, senseless thing.
Yeah.
He didn't have to go out that way. You know, and, but it's just, I mean, there's, I just know that no one can go so deep that God can't find them. Mm-hmm. It's impossible.
Did it affect your, you were said you were soul brothers with Keith. Did it affect your relationship as you grew older?
You know, what was so crazy, and I told this at Keith's funeral, Lori wanted me to kind of do the service. And I said, you know, this is really hard for me to stand here and know that that alcohol poisoning is what took Keith. And I said, I remember one time we were driving home we got off the road with Ralph and we stopped and bought, you know, some little half pints of liquor, you know. And I said, I remember getting so drunk on the way to Roy Lee's house in Jackson, Kentucky. I said, I was so drunk that I couldn't go home. I knew my mom and dad I wouldn't be able to go back out anymore, be so suspended. So I said, we got a hotel room, and Keith held my head while I was puking my guts up. I said, so he was here helping me, and I couldn't help him. I loved him dearly. We were great friends. I remember the last time I saw him, we were at the Opry, and Lori he and Lori and the band was walking toward the stage, and I was in the green room at the Opry, and sat down. We just started talking about old times, old days, and we laughing about Curly Ray and just crazy things we did, you know, with Ralph. And so anyway, he went on out there, and he just kind of turned and had those beautiful eyes, you know, and it was a really hard time, really hard time. And Nashville mourned, you know. He was such a bright, up-and-coming star, you know. But he influenced so many people with his singing. You hear all these young country singers, not so much now because they're not singing real country, but but you know, they're at that time, I'd say from, you know, 89 through the 90s up in the early 2000s, there were so many young artists that were huge fans of Keith that, you know, singing like him. But it's a tragedy. But, you know, I loved him so much, and miss him a lot. It'd be great to see what he would have become, you know.
So that's the end of the podcast, and we obviously have to thank Ricky Skaggs very, very much. Superstar of bluegrass, chatting away to us and sharing some really intimate, honest, emotional moments, really.
And taking a big chunk of his time to hang out with us. And he played my fiddle for us. He actually played Son of Hobart on my fiddle at the end of the interview. So here to play you out of the podcast is Ricky Skaggs, old-time fiddler. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe on iTunes or follow us on Spotify to keep up with all the latest episodes. Yeah.